seconds.
Yes. And so, you know, there are things beyond, again, just the sexual harassment claims, which are serious and sufficient in their own right to begin impeachment proceedings. But the nursing home deaths, where he covered up the deaths, the number of deaths, so that he could make it seem as if he had done a better job than he did. Why? So that he could get a book deal that allowed him to make $5 million and profit during a time when the state of New York not only was the state with the largest number of deaths, but the state that had the greatest amount of need, with a leader who was more concerned, again, with serving his own needs rather than the needs of New Yorkers and protecting the most vulnerable, those who were in nursing homes. And the result of that was that we lost 15,000 elderly because of decisions that he made that were uninformed and irresponsible.
Alessandra Biaggi, I want to thank you for being with us. New York State Senator representing parts of the Bronx and Westchester called on Andrew Cuomo to resign since February. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Sylvester the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown declares a state of emergency for Oregon due to upcoming high temperatures. The Senate passes a sweeping $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo resigns amid sexual harassment accusations. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 10th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Governor Kate Brown declared a heat state of emergency in Oregon on Tuesday after the National Weather Service forecasted dangerously high temperatures starting Wednesday, August 11th. Brown said in the announcement, quote, "Oregon is facing yet another extreme heat wave, and it is critical that every level of government has the resources they need to help keep Oregonians safe and healthy. I encourage Oregonians to take proactive steps to keep themselves and their families safe, including drinking plenty of fluids, taking advantage of cooling centers, and checking in on neighbors, friends, and loved ones," end quote. The state of emergency declaration is intended to ensure additional resources are available to respond to the excessively high temperatures. Multnomah County and the City of Portland issued similar declarations intended to coordinate responses to the heat. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kufuri said, quote, "This tool gives us the flexibility to respond to the heat wave and to alert everyone that heat is dangerous, especially for isolated older adults, people who work outdoors, children, and pets. There can be no doubt after June that extreme heat can kill, and we are treating these events like the health hazard they are," end quote. The excessive heat warning will be in effect Wednesday afternoon through Saturday night, although not quite as hot as the late June heat wave that reached 116 degrees, the Weather Service still advises residents to take precautions. The heat wave in late June claimed 96 Oregon lives, with the majority of the victims residing in Portland. Information on cooling centers and other resources is available by calling 211 or by going online to 211info.org. Multnomah County officials announced on Monday that the county is reinstating its mask mandate for indoor public settings. The executive order goes into effect Friday, August 13th. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kufuri said the mandate will apply to everyone age 5 and older in indoor public settings, regardless of vaccination status. People in violation of the mandate could face fines of up to $1,000, but Kufuri said they will start with education before enforcing fines. The rules do not apply to people actively eating or drinking in food establishments. Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines said the Delta variant is to blame for the new requirement. Vines added, quote, "A vaccinated person may still get a mild infection and may still be contagious, which is why we're asking everyone to wear a mask indoors," end quote. Doctors and nurses in Oregon say they are overwhelmed as bed capacity is becoming severely limited and more people need care due to COVID-19. According to new data modeling, if hospitalizations continue to rise at their current rate, the state would need 500 more hospital beds by September 7th. Dr. John Moorhead, an attending physician in the emergency room at OHSU, said the surge in COVID-19 cases they are seeing statewide is being driven by people who are not vaccinated. The Oregon Health Authority corrected information it released last week on COVID cases and deaths in fully vaccinated people. In July, 19% of COVID cases and 18% of deaths were in people who were fully vaccinated. OHA had previously said that just 9% of deaths occurred in fully vaccinated people. The overall number of breakthrough cases remains small compared to the 2.3 million Oregon residents who have completed a COVID vaccine series. Health officials say the best way to protect yourself during the pandemic is to get the vaccine. People who are vaccinated still experience less severe symptoms compared to those who are unvaccinated. Workers in Washington state are calling for more respect in contract negotiations after playing a critical role for their employers over a tough year and a half during the COVID-19 pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Washington state workers who showed up throughout the pandemic are feeling disrespected by their employers as the state opens up. About 1,200 education support professionals from SEIU Local 1948 in the Bethel School District south of Tacoma are in contract negotiations. At a school board meeting today, they'll be holding a rally and calling for proper compensation for their work throughout the pandemic. Jen Hansen is a student resource specialist and union chapter president. She says their unofficial slogan is to fight the fight to make it right.
We need our pay brought up so that we can support our families and be respected.
Members of SEIU Local 1948 include child nutrition, transportation, and maintenance staff. Hansen says they continue to show up at schools even as learning went remote. Teachers who received a raise from the district will be at the rally today to support their colleagues. The Bethel School District says they've collaboratively solved many areas of interest with the union and are working to conclude negotiations as soon as possible. Brittany Jones has been a registered nurse in Harborview Medical Center's emergency department for more than a decade and a half. She says work during the pandemic has been stressful and scary, and she saw many nurses leave the profession completely. Jones says she and other nurses from SEIU 1199 feel like they've been slapped in the face by Harborview as they go through contract negotiations.
My coworkers and I are angry. We're angry that we're not being respected and that we're not being compensated. And it's all interwoven. So if Harborview can't respect us enough to pay us enough to stay, it affects the entire community.
In a statement, the University of Washington Medicine says it's put forward its largest package ever with some of the biggest wage increases ever offered, including an 8% increase over 2 years for registered nurses. Hansen says the rally today is to emphasize the critical role of education support staff for schools.
Without us, you're not going to have schools in session. And so treat us with respect so that we can show you that we want to respect our schools and our students and our community.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced today that he will resign amid sexual harassment accusations. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will resign following an outpouring of sexual harassment allegations. About a week ago, the New York Attorney General released results of an investigation finding Cuomo sexually harassed at least 11 women. Alleged behaviors included unwanted kisses, groping sensitive areas, making suggestive remarks about looks, and creating a work environment subject to intimidation. Cuomo still denied intentionally mistreating women and called the allegations politically motivated. The resignation takes effect in 2 weeks. Momentum was already building to impeach Cuomo and to remove the third-term governor. Many leaders previously called upon him to resign, including President Joe Biden. Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul will become governor. She's the first woman to hold that New York office. She tweeted the resignation was, quote, the right thing to do and in the best interest of New Yorkers, end quote. The resignation almost certainly ends a bigger political career. Cuomo was planning to run for another term in 2022, and experts touted him as a potential candidate for United States president. Early in the pandemic, Cuomo received praise for his handling of coronavirus. Later, though, it was revealed that Cuomo's policies may have been undercounting COVID deaths in nursing homes. Republicans asked the New York legislature to impeach him despite his resignation over both the sexual assault allegations and the nursing home deaths. A successful attempt would likely prevent Cuomo from seeking office again. Meanwhile, a number of New York investigators are still pushing for criminal charges. At least one accuser has filed a criminal complaint against Cuomo. New York State Attorney General Letitia James said, quote, today closes a sad chapter for all of New York, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
No charges will be filed against the police officers who shot and killed Dalal Eid on December 30th, 2020. Eid was a 23-year-old Somali man and the first person killed by Minneapolis police after the murder of George Floyd. Eid's killing late last year sparked a new wave of protests from an already grieving community. With more on the story, it's Tiffany Bowie with the Racial Reckoning Project.
The Dakota County Attorney's Office will not press charges against the Minneapolis police officers who shot and killed Dalal Eid at a gas station in December. Eid was a 23-year-old Somali man and the first person killed by Minneapolis police since George Floyd. His death sparked a fresh wave of protests from an already grieving community. Eid was under investigation for illegally selling firearms. Through a confidential informant, police set up a sting operation and arranged to buy a gun from Eid at a Holiday gas station. The county attorney, Kathy Kina, wrote in a memo released Thursday that Eid shot out of the driver's side window and three officers returned fire. Kina concluded that the officers' actions were, quote, legally justified. Activists pushed back against Kina's decision outside of Governor Tim Walz' mansion last week. They called on Walz to assign the case to Attorney General Keith Ellison's office, as the governor did in the prosecution against Derek Chauvin. Jelani Hussein, who is the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Minnesota, demanded that Eid's family be given access to all available footage of his death.
What the public needs to know is that the family reached out to the interim county prosecutor asking for information in the nearly 100 days that passed in the killing of Dalal Eid, and we came up with nothing.
Dalal Eid's father, Bela Gila, questioned why police didn't try to apprehend him in a different way, or why police initially said it was a traffic stop.
The decision they was making today, it is injustice. We don't believe what they were saying.
After the sting operation, police raided the home of Eid's parents in Eden Prairie. Once officers finished their search, they informed Gila that his son had been killed. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Tiffany Bowie.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
The U.S. Senate on Tuesday passed a massive $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill, a significant win for President Joe Biden and the first step in one of his legislative priorities. The bill, called the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, includes $550 billion in new federal spending over 5 years. The bill invests $110 billion in roads, bridges, and major projects, $66 billion in passenger and freight rail, and $39 billion to modernize and expand transit systems. The legislation also includes $65 billion each to rebuild the electric grid and expand broadband internet access, as well as $7.5 billion to build a national network of charging infrastructure for electric vehicles. Additionally, the bill sets aside $55 billion for water infrastructure, $15 billion of which will be directed toward replacing lead pipes. The bill was spearheaded by a bipartisan group of senators led by Senator Kyrsten Sinema, a Democrat from Arizona, and Rob Portman, a Republican from Ohio. According to a Congressional Budget Office analysis, the bill would add $256 billion to the deficit, although supporters argue that infrastructure projects pay for themselves over time. The legislation passed the Senate by a wide bipartisan majority of 69 to 30, with 19 Republicans voting for the bill. The bill now heads to the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives. The timing of the vote in the House is not certain, but it is unlikely they will take up the bill until the fall. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has signaled that the bill will not be taken up in the House until a larger, separate spending package is passed that includes Democrats' top priorities. The Senate passage of the bill tees up Democrats to turn to their $3.5 trillion plan, which they will try to pass through the Senate without GOP support. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, featuring Barbara Bernstein's story of several communities in the Pacific Northwest who are fighting mammoth fracked gas projects that would turn the region into a fracked gas export hub. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 70 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 101 degrees. The National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat warning beginning tomorrow, Wednesday at noon, that lasts through Saturday night. Dangerously hot conditions, with temperatures up to 105 degrees, are expected in the region. Today in history, in 1846, the Smithsonian Institution is created after a decade of debate about how to best spend a bequest left to America from an obscure English scientist. In 1829, James Smithson died in Italy, leaving behind a will with a peculiar footnote. In the event his only nephew died without any heirs, Smithson decreed that the entirety of his estate would go to the U.S. to found an institution for the advancement of knowledge. Smithson's curious endowment to a country that he had never visited aroused significant attention on both sides of the Atlantic. The quote of the day is from American poet and activist Langston Hughes, who said, quote, "Hold fast to dreams, for if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly." The UN says climate change is accelerating, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen wants to raise the debt ceiling, and the Arizona presidential election audit nears an end. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. accumulation of greenhouse gases is going up and up faster over time. Response in terms of, say, temperature is going up essentially proportionately. And things like sea level rise are also going up faster and faster.
Mark Howden, vice chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, talked about the group's new report, which warns the Earth could face runaway global temperature changes unless drastic efforts are made to reduce greenhouse gases. Scientists concluded average global temperatures will likely rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2040, based on carbon emissions already in the atmosphere. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress Monday to pass a bipartisan resolution to raise the amount of money the U.S. government can borrow, saying failing to increase the debt ceiling would cause irreparable harm to the economy. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell warned Republicans won't help.
Democrats have all the existing tools they need to raise the debt limit on a partisan basis. If they want 50 lockstep Democratic votes to spend trillions and trillions more, they can find 50 Democratic votes.
Meanwhile, Democrats released their $3.5 trillion budget resolution Monday as they prepared to pass the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. The chamber will approve the infrastructure plan as soon as today. Florida Senator Rick Scott.
The reckless Democrat spending is causing inflation. I mean, look all around the country. Gas prices are up a buck, food prices are up, car prices are up, home prices are up.
Melissa DeRosa, the top aide to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, has resigned as state lawmakers continue to call on the governor to step down. Speaker of the New York State Assembly, Carl Hastie.
The governor's clearly lost the confidence of the majority members of the New York State Assembly. The Attorney General's report lays out in painful detail the many instances and ways in which he reportedly harassed and created a hostile work environment.
A widely criticized Republican-led review of the 2020 general election in Arizona appears to be nearing the finish line. The Maricopa County probe, ordered by GOP state senators, has lasted weeks longer than anticipated. Now the company leading the review, Cyber Ninjas, a Florida-based cybersecurity firm with no prior experience in elections, says it's preparing a final report on its findings. Finally, Philip Morris International has raised its bid against global private equity fund Carlyle Group to acquire Vectura, a UK-based drug manufacturer specializing in inhaled medicines, to $1.4 billion. Experts say the big tobacco company is remaking its image as it invests in cigarette alternatives and treatments for respiratory illnesses. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A court in Ontario, Canada, has ruled against a First Nations claim to land and part of the Lake Huron lakebed. 6 tribes appealed 12 water rights permits granted to the company trying to build a large gold mine in southwest Alaska, and the Interior Department clears the way for a gaming compact between Florida and the Seminole Tribe of Florida. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. A court in Ontario rules against the First Nations claim to land in part of the Lake Huron lakebed. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the precedent-setting decision was the first time Aboriginal title to waters has been decided by Canadian court.
The claim for the rights to millions of acres of land and lakebed was brought by the Saugeen First Nation. They were joined by the Chippewas of Nawash Unceded First Nation. But following a trial of a year and a half, an Ontario judge ruled that the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation does not hold title to the waters of Lake Huron that border their territory. Here's Saugeen First Nation Chief Lester Anaquat.
The lakebed claim obviously would have had ramifications across Canada had it been a favorable decision. Our traditional teachings and our ancestors told us that we've been here since time immemorial. If not, even archaeological digs have demonstrated we've been occupying the territory for over 3,000 to 5,000 years.
The court did side with the First Nations in their claim that the British Crown broke a promise in 1836 to protect the entire Bruce Peninsula in exchange for 1.5 million acres of land. As compensation, the First Nations want $90 billion and recognition of interests in lands on the peninsula, especially those owned by 3 levels of government. Most local governments are fighting the land claim. One county has settled out of court while another is working towards that. Meanwhile, Anaquat would not say if the Saugeen Ojibwe Nations would appeal the judge's decision on their claim to the waters, but now that the claim has been heard, he says it's a positive step and at least a dialogue can begin. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Donlin Gold wants to build a large gold mine in southwest Alaska. In July, six tribes appealed 12 water rights permits that Alaska's Department of Natural Resources issued. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports on why the tribes oppose the permits.
The 12 water rights permits allow Donlin to use local water sources for a variety of purposes. One will allow the mine to pump out groundwater so it can dig a pit. The law firm Earth Justice represents six Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Region tribes in their legal battles against the mine. In its appeal on behalf of the tribes, Earth Justice is focusing on several key factors. One is the lack of tribal consultation at the state level. Tom Barrett is the chief of water resources for the state.
There is not a government-to-government consultation process in the state permitting process.
There is, however, a mandated government-to-government consultation process at the federal level. Earth Justice attorneys argue that the tribes need to be explicitly consulted at the state level, too. Earth Justice and DNR are also at odds about the permitting process for the mine, which is divvied up by category among federal and state agencies. The DNR water chief says having multiple departments involved allows for greater oversight into the mine. But Earth Justice attorney Tom Waldo says the process is piecemeal and will lead to devastating consequences for subsistence users and the environment.
That includes mercury pollution in an area that already has high levels of mercury. There's the operation of bigger barges. They will cause erosion, destroying smelt spawning habitat.
Plus, Waldo says it's against the law. Now that Earth Justice has filed this appeal for the tribes, it goes back to the desk of the DNR commissioner. Earth Justice expects her decision later this month. If she rules against the six tribes, they could appeal again in the Superior Court. In Bethel, Alaska, I'm Olivia Eberts.
The U.S. Interior Department cleared the way for a gaming compact between the Seminole Tribe of Florida and the state. The agreement is expected to create more than 2,200 jobs. For National Native News, I'm Tripp Krause.
A new United Nations report on climate change shows a world still moving toward major sea level rise and weather extremes due to climate change. And advocates say the U.S. West Coast is already feeling the effects. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Advocates say the new UN report waving red flags on climate change is particularly critical for California, where megafires and persistent drought already are becoming the norm. The report also predicts 6 to 12 inches of sea level rise by mid-century. Mary Kreisman with the California League of Conservation Voters says the way forward is to wean our transportation and buildings off of oil and gas and stop using single-use plastics made from petroleum.
We need a government that is going to mandate and regulate corporate polluters, fossil fuel industries, carbon emissions to get to the change we need by 2030. That's the solution.
Nonetheless, this year, California lawmakers have stalled or killed bills to require new buildings to be all electric, hold corporate polluters accountable, and ban new fracking permits. Advocates are gathering signatures for a ballot initiative to limit single-use plastics. Opponents say these measures would burden an economy already hard hit by COVID. Kreisman, however, says we need action like that on a national scale from the Biden administration and Congress, and that will depend on the results of the 2022 midterm election.
The problem is that we don't have the political will and the political power to do it at the rate and scale that science tells us we have to.
California has been a leader on other fronts in the battle against climate change. The state will require that by 2035, all personal cars sold will be zero-emission vehicles, with clean trucks mandated by 2045. The state has set a goal to preserve 30% of lands and water by 2030 and become carbon neutral by 2045. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 10th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Tiffany Bowie, Tripp Krause, Nadia Romlagon, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, featuring art, culture, and politics, with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's the Children's Hour, educational and entertaining programming for listeners of all ages. Then at 11, it's The Dirtbag. Host Glenn Anderson is joined by Jim Gilbert to talk about National Peach Month, seasonal pruning, and summer harvesting. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact.
Making contact.
Now to growing concerns about the deadly coronavirus officially hitting the U.S. Here's what we know.
All schools closing in a growing number of states, houses of worship suspending services, landmarks, theme parks, sporting events, and concerts shutting down. The chaos at grocery stores, lines stretching out the door, shelves cleared out.
The disturbing scene caught on tape, a black man pinned to the ground, later dying after a white officer kneeled on his neck. The man heard saying, "I can't breathe."
...2020 was unprecedented in many respects. The COVID-19 pandemic, a reckoning with policing in the U.S., and a contentious presidential election. If we knew before last year that major events trigger spikes in gun purchases, it should be no surprise that 2020, and even the first few months of 2021, are shaping up to be some of the biggest years ever for firearms purchases.
My name is Lawrence Taylor, aka DJ Styles, and I just became a gun owner last year for the first time.
Lawrence is a California school teacher and a DJ.
When we went into lockdown on coronavirus, I feared the worst. I just thought we were gonna have like food droughts and water rations and putting gas in plastic bags. And you know, I feared the worst. And so part of me, like I really went into prepper mode and started stacking up like all of my food rations and stuff like that. If you have all the food and other people didn't prepare, you become a target. You need to protect yourself. And I mean, amongst all the other things. So it was something in me clicked with, I need to get a firearm at this point.
Lawrence was not alone. According to our estimates, across the country, more than 22.7 million guns were ordered last year. And in California, over 1.3 million guns were ordered. But the sales estimates don't tell you who bought those guns or why first-time buyers like Lawrence were motivated to make that purchase. Mark Oliva is the Public Affairs Director for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the Firearms Industry Trade Association.
Partway through the year last year, we wanted to be able to get a handle on who was buying these guns. So we put out a survey to our retailers to find out, you know, who exactly is buying these guns, because there's nowhere that you can go for a national registry to be able to see that Mark didn't own a gun yesterday, but today he does. So we have to ask the retailers, what do you see in your stores? And what they told us is that 40% of the people who were buying guns last year were buying a gun for the very first time. And that is a tectonic shift in the conversation of who's buying firearms today.
We at Making Contact conducted our own small survey to get a better sense of not just who's buying guns, but what they do with it once they get it. That's how we connected with Lawrence Taylor. He answered our survey and talked about training.
So I actually started out going to the gun range with a group of guys I know. And then there is a black shooting group up above Sacramento that we're a part of. And we go up there once a month or every 2 months. And they're actually in that group are some licensed NRA instructors.
Mark Oliva.
Prior to 2020, people wanted to kind of put gun owners into a box and say, well, gun owners are, you know, old, male, and pale. People who might look a lot like me. You know, I'm a 47-year-old white guy living in the suburbs of D.C. But I don't know that you can apply that adage to today's gun buyer. They're certainly much younger. They're much more diverse. They're more reflective of who we are as an American society. And I think it's a realization among some of the people in these demographic groups that the Second Amendment applies to everybody. It is not a white right. It is not a black right. It is a right of every citizen at their birth.
Beyond race, sex, and age, we also wanted to know how gun owners identify politically. Some first-time buyers, like Lawrence, had once been strongly opposed to guns, let alone owning one. In our sample, a little less than half of survey respondents identified as Democrat. 35% were independent, and 2% were Republican. But we saw people name a broad range of political identifiers. One gun group who helped to promote the survey among their members is called LA Progressive Shooters. Tom Wynn started the group last year.
It's almost like when you're a person of a liberal background and belief system, but you also like guns and you enjoy guns, it's almost like a dirty secret, right? Like you don't talk about it around your liberal-minded friends because they're going to think, what are you, crazy, right? There's that certain stigma about gun owners. You know, we tend to think of it very, you know, it's very simplistic, right? There's the stereotype of what a gun owner is. A typical gun owner, from a liberal point of view, are very conservative-minded folks who are overly paranoid and they glamorize guns and violence. That's the stereotype of a gun owner. And I'm not that stereotype.
LA Progressive Shooters first caught my attention because I'd been following another one of Tom's arts and culture accounts, Enclave LA. He's been a software engineer, surf instructor, and developed a grassroots marketing company for clients like the Hollywood Bowl and the LA Philharmonic. When shelter-in-place orders hit, Tom's business came to a halt as well. A few industries, however, took off.
My name is Geneva Solomon. I am co-owner of Redstone Firearms in Burbank, California. There has been a huge difference in gun sales and demographic of those patronizing our store. And I think a lot of that has to do with not just our business model, but things that were going on around the country. We've seen probably 100% increase in business It was the pandemic that started it, but then there were other things that began to happen after the pandemic that kept gun sales up.
Mm-hmm. And what were those other things?
So the civil unrest across the country, we started to see violence within the black community. And I think what happened in 2020 is those people who have grown up thinking that guns were bad and bad really started to learn and understand the history of firearms and within the black community, and understanding that it may have been by design that we have been conditioned not to want to touch a firearm or learn about it responsibly. And so it was the shift of the pandemic and people being afraid of people coming into their homes to steal their resources. And then it went to, wait a minute, I'm starting to see people within my own communities trying to rely on our police department to protect me, but they're not really protecting me. And if I dial 911, will I somehow end up being the suspect that turns into the victim? But I'm just calling 911 because I'm really truly afraid for my life. And so you have to understand the strains of the relationship between, well, if I can't really rely on 911 to protect me, then what else do I have?
Simply viewing this guide will not make you a safe gun owner. Safety comes only from carefully following all applicable rules and laws.
You're responsible for knowing the rules of gun safety.
You're responsible for knowing the right way to store a handgun.
And you're responsible for always handling your gun safely, legally, and responsibly.
The process for getting a gun differs by state. I went through the motions this year to get a better understanding of what's involved.
And then did you want to laminate the certificate for $2?
Sure.
Basically, you watch the California DOJ video, download the written study guide, slap down some cash at a local sporting goods store or firing range, and take a multiple choice quiz.
So you go to the gun counter. This is the test. You're going to go ahead, read this sign here, fill in the bubbles for your answers. Questions are on the inside.
Okay.
There you go. And
thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello. After that, you're good to go to pick out a California approved firearm. Some people think the process is too easy, while others believe it's quite rigorous. LA Progressive Shooters founder, Tom Wynn.
You just read the guide and you can, okay, I'll tell you what. I didn't even study, Monica. I just went in based on my 15-year-old knowledge of guns and I passed it. I missed one question. So if you study it, knowing nothing about guns, if you study it, you can pass the test. No question. It doesn't even mean that you know how to safely operate a gun. You just read about it. Basically, you passed the test saying that you were pretty good at reading about it, right? And memorizing the answers to the questions. Okay, that in no way makes you qualified to safely and responsibly own and operate a gun.
Every experience is unique and dependent on the kind of service a business offers. Geneva Solomon talks about why she bought her first gun.
One, I was a victim of domestic violence, so that was what prompted me to go purchase a firearm. So I was already at a fragile state, and I was married, and I had a small child, and I walk into a gun store, it's nothing but men. I love men, you know, but it was nothing but men. And I had a ton of questions because I knew nothing about the process. I knew I couldn't just walk in a gun store, put down some money, and walk out, but I wanted to educate myself, and it was like they were jerks. The guys were jerks. He would walk away, take 45 minutes, come back. And I was like, so, you know, this gun is $600. Can you tell me more about it? He's like, just pick it up and fill it and let me know if you want to buy it. And it just felt horrible. And then I asked him, hey, do you know of any instructors in the area that I could, you know, I was making good money. I didn't care what it cost. Any instructors in the area that I can pay for some training? And they flat out told me no. They didn't. I kind of call BS on that, but I still walked out. I'm resilient. I'm a fighter. And I found someone, and I learned to use that firearm.
How are we doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
Not bad. Training bay 3? Okay.
Yeah.
So you are meeting up with somebody?
Yes, I am.
In March, I met up with Tom and other members of the LA Progressive Shooters at a firing range in San Bernardino, California.
Hey, Tom. Good to meet you in person.
Oh, you too.
Hi. They had an assortment of guns, handguns, shotguns, automatic rifles operated by new and experienced shooters.
All right, so we're going to do rifle shooting. One, two, three. It looks like we have enough room for up to 3 shooters. Okay.
Tom started the group with a couple of friends in June of 2020, smack dab in the middle of the lockdown and at the height of Black Lives Matter protests across the country. His ex-girlfriend, Vanna, was about to go on a road trip by herself, and Tom was concerned for her safety. She became his first unofficial firearm student.
So it's sighted in, the way it's sighted in. You gotta aim below the clay.
Yeah, so...
So the next thing I did was, I decided, you know what, I'm just gonna post a video of me shooting guns and with Vanna shooting guns. You know, no caption, no comment, and just kind of test the waters and see how people react. And I was fully expected to get a lot of pushback to maybe, you know, my followers saying, what is going on with Tom, right? What is this, right? What is he doing with a gun? And surprisingly, the first comment I got was a direct message from an acquaintance of mine. He's in one of my favorite LA bands, one of the most gentle souls I know in LA. And he messaged me, he goes, Tom, you shoot guns? Like, you know, and he was totally like taken aback. Like, of all the people he thought would be into guns, I was the last person, right, that he would have thought of. And he felt comfortable in confiding in me, hey, you know what? I actually bought a gun. I don't know how to use it. I don't know how to shoot it. But with the unrest and pandemic, you know, my wife and I, we just bought a new house. I just want to feel like I can defend ourselves. So I bought this gun. I don't know how to use it. Will you show me how to use it? And I was like, absolutely. Absolutely, I'll teach you, right? And so I took him to the range and taught him how to use the gun. And word spread through our LA music community among our friends. And I'm not kidding you, Monica, the next two or three folks that approached me were from other LA bands or from the music community who wanted to learn how to shoot guns.
Among the gun owners who answered our survey, 90% said they had sought out some firearms training or support after buying a gun. One disturbing change last year is that gun homicides increased in major cities across the country. According to data from the California Department of Public Health, the state also saw an increase in gun homicides. From the previous 5 years, gun homicides last year increased by over 25% in California. Shortly after two mass shootings in Georgia and Colorado in March of this year, Democratic Senator John Ossoff asks Dr. Selwyn Rogers, Trauma Center Director at the University of Chicago Medicine, to speak about the increase in violence.
2 weeks, two massacres. And there's also a broader increase in violence across our society over the last year in particular. With your experience, Dr. Rogers, could you reflect, please, on what is driving this broader increase in violence? And what do you assess to be the causes of our nearly uniquely American problem of repeated massacres and spree shootings?
In my opinion, the almost 50% increase that we've seen in Chicago and so many cities across this country of shootings is related to the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact it's had socially and economically on so many distressed communities. And in many ways, gun violence, intentional gun violence, is a symptom of a larger problem in our society. The ready availability of guns puts people at risk, but unfortunately, disproportionately, those communities that are at risk are communities of color. And we aren't really addressing the upstream factors that lead to this unfortunate, as Senator Booker said, slaughter. And the slaughter of Americans, of mostly black and brown Americans in this country, has gone on for decades. Tackling that problem is really what we should be focusing on. I think, unfortunately, we don't address the root causes of gun violence. And we see this time and time again. We'll have another hearing in another year or another decade if we don't do some action now to address the problem fundamentally.
Dr. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is an historian and the author of Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. In Loaded, she argues that understanding the purpose of the Second Amendment is key to understanding the gun culture of the United States. Part of that is also tied to the business of gun production.
It was actually the first U.S. corporation. Alexander Hamilton commissioned the Springfield Armory in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War as a corporation. It is still the only industry that did not go offshore. The United States is the largest manufacturer of small weapons, supplies 45% of the small weapons in the world. So it's a thriving industry. The corporate interest has a lot to do with making guns very available and making tons of money.
As Dr. Dunbar-Ortiz writes in her book, the Second Amendment is a simple statement. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the purpose of it, she says, was laid out in various documents throughout history.
In the Northwest Ordinance, which became a part of the Constitution of how to take Indian land, that is all they talked about, is how to defeat the Native people and take their land. So what they adopted with the Second Amendment were the Indian militias that existed. Like I say, they weren't written into laws, as nothing was, you know, and there was no constitution under the British. These were locally mandated all over the colonies. They had trainers straight out of the British wars against Turkey, you know, where they were annihilating villages. And they had them in Maine as well. They brought them with them. The pilgrims brought with them the mercenary who would be in charge of organizing the militias to go kill the Indians. So this is 150 years of doing this. So they put it in the Second Amendment. That's what they refer to. And I interpret the well-regulated meaning. They're not highwaymen, you know, robbers. They're not Robin Hoods. They're organized. They were very organized. They're self-organized, though, not by the government. That's what settler colonialism is self-organization.
Tom Wynn may be a professional firearms trainer now, but his relationship to guns early in life was very different.
And in high school, this is in the late 80s, I noticed my dad kept a small gun in his bedroom. So me being this scrawny kid that was always getting bullied, you know, guess what I did? Well, I started taking my dad's gun to school. I thought that, you know, it would make me feel like a badass, that the kids would respect me more knowing that I had a gun. And one night when my parents weren't home, I decided to invite all the buddies over, you know, to show off, right? Typical teenage bravado. Hey guys, come on over. You know, gather around. Let me show you my dad's gun. And I went to load it and boom, the gun went off. I didn't even squeeze a trigger. And to this day, I don't know how I didn't shoot my friend standing right in front of the muzzle, Monica. It was miraculous that I didn't hurt anyone, right? I could have shot somebody, right? So that was my first experience with a real gun. It shows you how irresponsible my father was as a gun owner, that he himself didn't even know the gun was defective because he's never even shot it himself, right? And that how easy it is for his child to access his gun without him knowing about it. He stored it in a file cabinet that I could easily pick the lock with a paperclip. And then fast forward to age 21, the year after that, I got kicked out of college. And so, you know, for my strict immigrant father, who sacrificed so much to see his oldest son go to college, you know, he wasn't too happy about that. So, you know, he kicked me out of the house thinking, you know, yeah, you're worthless. Get out of my house. So at age 21, Monica, I was thinking, yeah, I guess my future is done. But what I could do at age 21 was buy my first handgun. So at age 21, I bought my first handgun with the intention of committing suicide.
Dr. Doreen Marshall is the Vice President for Mission Engagement at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
We talk about firearm and safe storage as being such a key component of suicide prevention, because if people are storing their firearms safely and, you know, locked and unloaded, you know, inaccessible, particularly to a person in crisis, that can save a life. And a lot of people think, well, isn't someone just going to find another method if I prevent a primary method that they've chosen? And the research shows us that most people won't switch methods. So if you can find a way to kind of put what we call time and space between a person and their chosen method for suicide, you can really help save a life.
Ultimately, that time and space is what saved Tom.
Whatever crisis or despair someone is going through, it's a transitory, momentary feeling at that point in their life. And so by reaching for a firearm, unfortunately, what they've reached for is a tool that is usually pretty lethal, so you don't get a chance to get over that despair or get through that moment, right? A lot of folks, it's normal for you to go through despair, to go through depression, to have a moment, and you just want that feeling to stop. So fortunately, in my case, I had time to contemplate my decision, and the feeling of despair passed.
One bit of cautiously encouraging news from 2020 is that the overall number of suicides, and suicides by firearm, decreased both nationally and in California.
We know the overall number went down. I think as we dig into the data and look at whether it's age or race, ethnicity, that the numbers went up. I mean, I'd be speculating, but I will say, you know, what's consistent is that when we've seen other times in history where there's been what I think of as like large scale community level events, so whether it's a war or those, we tend to see suicide rates do go down in the immediate. Because what tends to happen for, you know, the human experience, I think, is that people tend to see themselves as in things together. And so when we're all impacted by something, we have a really clear reason for why things are not good. In this last year, it's been the pandemic has been a big reason for people about why things are not good. But then I think as things start to improve, you still have a number of folks who are saying, yeah, things are getting better, but they're not getting better for me. And so making sure that we continue our prevention efforts as we move out of this kind of intense pandemic phase is going to be ever more important because we don't want to see these rates go back up.
That's what Dr. Marshall's group is doing. The American Foundation for Suicide is working to reduce the annual rate of suicide by 20%. She shared a staggering figure that's relevant to gun owners. 2/3 of all gun deaths are gun suicides.
We knew that if we didn't do something in the area of firearms, it would be very hard to get a reduction.
Michael Sodini's aim is to connect the firearms community with people who work in mental health and suicide prevention.
I started Walk the Talk America in 2018 after a chance meeting with a complete stranger that asked the question, if the firearms industry blames the mental health community or says mass shootings are a product of mental health, then how does the firearm industry work with mental health? You think the two would work together? And that question really changed my life because before then, I owned a firearms importer. And in 2009, we had lost the president of our company to suicide by firearm.
Michael says that some firearm owners worry about seeking help even if they're experiencing a mental health crisis.
Even talking to counselors is talked about in one big sweeping boogeyman type experience. Like, oh, they're going to ask you about your guns. And then when you say you have them, then they're going to, you know, they're going to be on edge. Well, that's one of the reasons why we do like free and anonymous mental health screenings. We also bring mental health clinicians into what we call it's almost a firearms guns 101 class. It's a cultural competence class, which we give CEU credits for people that complete it.
Dr. Doreen Marshall.
You can easily gain trust and you can lose it just as quickly. So if you're trying to work with someone around their suicide risk and owning a firearm and you're using incorrect terms or you're showing that you clearly do not understand what owning a firearm is like, you can lose them, right? Or they may not trust that you're somebody they can really talk about this challenge with. So I think the more familiar you can get with the terminology, the concerns of gun owners, those sorts of things, it does empower you more as a clinician to have these conversations openly and to have them on an ongoing basis.
Tom Wynn.
I started telling these stories to my students as kind of a lesson for them. All the bad connotations they may have about guns are true, right? I've done those things. I negligently fired a firearm and almost hurt somebody. I took it to school, right? As a young youth, I witnessed gun violence. I've contemplated suicide with a gun. So, you know, all those things associated with guns, I've experienced those things. And it's because of those early experiences with guns is why as an instructor today, I'm so passionate about empowering folks with the knowledge they need so that they don't have to go through what I did, right? I didn't have a good support system around guns. I didn't have someone telling me right from wrong around guns. I don't want that for my students. I want them to be empowered with all the information they need to make the best decision for themselves when it comes to owning and operating a gun.
And that may mean making the choice to forego a gun purchase altogether. If you or a loved one is experiencing a mental health crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Or text TALK, T-A-L-K, to 741741. This program was produced as part of a project of the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism Data Fellowship. It was researched, written, and produced by Monica Lopez. Special thanks to Andrew Tran, Danielle Fox, Susan Racho, Henry Lopez, Dr. Marisela Marquez, Anita Johnson, and our community outreach coordinator, Sandina Robbins. The Making Contact team is Sonia Green, Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, Sabine Blazin, and I'm Monica Lopez, reporting from Los Angeles. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulé.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we bring you a special on Black and Palestinian solidarity in the face of global systemic racism. In 2019, U.S. police killed 1,099 people, according to Mapping Police Violence.